Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Joining us on the line now is Professor Ben Horton. And Ben was part of an article that came out on the 8th of the month talking about the effects of climate change and sea level rise. Ben, of course, is the chair of the Asian School of the Environment at NTU here in Singapore. Ben, good morning. Welcome to Weekend Mornings.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. And this the article, was at least the one I saw in The Guardian, was entitled Sea Levels Could Rise by More Than a Meter by 2100. And then it goes on to talk more and more about that. Pretty sobering analysis by yourself and some other scientists. Give us a rundown of what your findings on the paper that you wrote found.
Well, this is a paper that we wrote earlier this month. It was rather a novel approach where here we surveyed 100 of the experts in sea level science, and we asked them two questions based upon their knowledge of how sea level would change in the 21st century moving through to 2300. We asked them what they thought sea level would be under a low emission or a high emission scenario, and the results were quite conclusive regarding the extreme differences between whether we have a future of low carbon or high carbon. In the low carbon future, by 2100, you could expect a sea level rise of up to half a meter. Mm. However, under a high emission future, you could get a sea level rise of up to 1.3 meters by 2100 and up to 6 meters by 2300. So sea level is a very appropriate barometer to judge climate change, because to understand sea level rise, you need to understand how the atmosphere is going to change and how our oceans are going to change. And it clearly illustrates the importance of mitigating and reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Ben, one of the common arguments that that the anti-climate change groups often bring up is the fact that the climate change is cyclical. It happens. It's happened over time, over history. So this is just another case of, hey, it's getting warmer and stuff is melting, and it'll change back at some point in the future. Why is that? Is that true in this case? And you've interviewed 100 scientists. On what basis does this seem different, if in fact it does seem different, than a normal sort of pattern change over history?
Well, I mean, there's a positive element of that. We know that the Earth changes in its temperature and therefore its sea level response. Because we know that, we're able to predict the future. The Earth is obviously very, very complex, but it basically really has two buttons that change, or two dials that control global mean temperature. One is the output from the sun, and that changes through time due to the orbital relation of the Earth to the sun. And the other is the amount of greenhouse gases. We very fortunately have an unbelievable record of temperature and greenhouse gas concentrations recovered from cores in Antarctica that take us back over 1 million years. And in this, we see that the Earth changes its temperature, going from interglacials, which are what are we in today, to glacials. And whenever the interglacials are, we commonly have greenhouse gas concentrations of carbon dioxide of around 280 parts per million. Whenever we have glacials, we have a concentration of around 180 parts per million. What are we today? We're around 400 parts per million by volume. There's a very clear linear relationship between the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and temperature. And I'll just give you a little bit of an anecdote. Well, we know that temperatures of our Earth have increased since the Industrial Revolution by around 1 degree centigrade. And to your listeners, that may not sound very much. But 20,000 years ago, we were in the middle of an ice age. We had ice sheets covering much of Europe and North America. We had mammoths, saber-toothed tigers, and the temperature change caused sea levels to be a colossal 120 meters below present. And quite simply, you could walk from Singapore to the island of Sumatra. You could walk from Singapore to the east coast of Malaysia. Then our temperatures started to increase, and these ice sheets lost their mass, rose sea level catastrophically. And you may ask, well, how big was that temperature change? Well, that temperature change from the last glacial maximum to today was only 5 degrees centigrade. A 5 degrees centigrade caused a rise in sea level of 120 meters.
Wow.
Now, since the Industrial Revolution, we've risen temperature around 1 degree C. If we continue under a high emission future, by the end of this century, we'll have a further 4 degree C temperature change. And so you don't need to be a rocket scientist to understand what will happen to our ice sheets. They will melt, and they will melt catastrophically.
Well, you've actually anticipated my question there, Ben, which is to paint a picture. It's going to be a gloomy picture for our listeners. What does a 1 degree, a 1 meter rise in temperature in sea levels by 2100 and 5 meters by 2300, what does that mean in broad terms for the planet and also maybe specifically for Singapore?
Well, I'll take you on your first point. So the readers can have a gloomy picture of this, or I would turn this around and say you have a hopeful position of this. And that's what our sea level projection shows. If we make a decision as a society coming out of this COVID pandemic to go to a more sustainable future, we have approximately a 3 in 4 chance or a 6 in 10 chance to keep our sea levels to around half a meter. And when we're talking about a half a meter rise by 2100, we can successfully adapt Singapore and many other regions around the globe. And therefore, we can continue to live around the coastlines, have a strong infrastructure and an economy. The warning, and we have warnings again, the pandemic in COVID, we had enough warnings about there being a possible pandemic. And governments who didn't listen to scientific advice, who were not prepared, have been decimated by this crisis. Now, with climate change, this paper also provides a warning. If we don't do anything about it, a 1 meter rise by 2100 will have devastating effects. It's not just the rise, it's also the rate. So sea levels growing is growing quite gradually at the moment. So from around 1900, sea levels were around 1 millimeter per year. By the end of the 20th century, they'd risen to around 3 millimeters per year. And now we're doing around 4 millimeters per year. So we're getting an acceleration in the rate. By the sort of 2050, 2070 on our planet, the rates are going to be faster than any coastal ecosystem can adapt. So I know this because we have another paper coming out in June which looks at thresholds of mangrove response to sea level rise. And we say that when sea levels reach around 7 millimeters per year, the mangroves will start retreating and collapsing. So when you get these rates of rise, you're going to have huge impacts to do with sea level contaminating our aquifers, so will influence the drinking water supply in Singapore. We will have sea level contaminating our agricultural fields, which will influence the food supply in Singapore. We will have sea level rise increasing the impacts of storm surges. We currently have a project at the Asian School of the Environment looking at the impact of a rising sea level on storm surges that hit Singapore or surrounding countries. This is unknown, but I did a study a few years ago looking at the impact of Hurricane Sandy and sea level rise on New York City. So your listeners may be aware that back in 2012, a colossal storm hit New York City, causing Manhattan into darkness, causing $70 billion worth of damage. Well, if there hadn't been any sea level rise due to human activities, the likelihood of that event was to happen once every 500 years. But we have had sea level rise since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, so the likelihood of that event decreased to somewhere around 1 in 100 years. If we go under this high emission future, and this is quite staggering, by 2050, our models projected that an event of the magnitude of Hurricane Sandy would occur every 1 to 5 or 10 years.
Jesus.
So these are the these are scientific projections of what will happen to the climate. These are peer reviewed by fellow scientists. That came out in the proceedings of the National Academy. And we've tried to make society and governments aware of that, and they're the warnings. And as a society, we need to push our government as we come out of the COVID pandemic to look at green solutions or green strings to do with economic recovery.
You're speaking with Professor Ben Horton, the chair of the Asian School of the Environment at NTU. And Ben, the recent survey that you published, 106 scientists that you talked with, it was peer-reviewed, six peer reviews, a paper on it in academic journals. Is there any body of thought out there, any scientific thought that would contradict what you're saying, that would say, no, actually, you guys are overestimating what is likely to happen? Again, often some of the climate change denying noise out there says, actually, these things are not true. It's quite the opposite, or something. Is anybody disputing what your findings are saying?
Well, science is an industry that is based upon developing hypotheses and testing them. So we have a hypothesis that human activities are causing temperatures to rise and our climate to change. And a variety of scientists have tried to test that. And a recent survey showed that 97% of scientists show that humans are having an effect on the climate, and the climate will only get worse. Mm. There are obviously, when you're projecting everything into the future, you can have a variety of feedback effects that may take the Earth back to a new normal. But what we've commonly found is that our unknowns only increase the risk of climate change. So, for example, permafrost is one of the examples that we didn't understand, that if you increase temperatures, the permanently frozen areas in the large parts of the Northern Hemisphere would melt. And we didn't understand what impact that would have. These permafrost areas basically store huge volumes of methane, which is the most potent of greenhouse gases, only amplifying the effect. Mm. So I would say, and the survey paper points to this, we have a body of scientists who work on what's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They meet every 7 or so years to provide a report on the physical science basis, the mitigation, i.e. how can we solve it, and the adaptation, how do we live with it. And it has been aware that this is a consensus, and what our paper illustrated is that the IPCC is conservative. Our projections were higher than the body of scientists in the IPCC, for which I'm one of them. I'm a review editor on the IPCC. So what I would say about that is, of course, there are scientists who illustrate that maybe the Earth won't warm as quickly as we think, but the vast majority of them predict that the models will be correct, and there's a significant proportion of them that actually say it will be much worse than it is. I mean, I think when you're looking to, we're talking here about a climate emergency. We're talking about a threat to our civilization. And I think we must trust science, and we must trust the scientific peer review process. I mean, I saw in some of the news recently that a lot of people about COVID are getting incorrect sources of information. The same thing happens on climate change. But government officials and, for example, yourselves in the media must know that you must take information from peer review, information that's been reviewed by other scientists, not grey literature. Again, if we think about the COVID pandemic, the information is from scientists. We think about how the COVID pandemic is going to be solved. It's going to be solved by scientists. It's not going to be solved by a politician. It's not going to be solved by a celebrity. It doesn't matter what words you say. It's down to scientific information. And with climate, we've had 30 years of this. Some politicians have spoke nice words. Yes, we've signed up to the Paris Agreement, but we need actions. And in this terrible crisis of COVID, you know, they say that in every tragedy, there is an opportunity. And I think the COVID pandemic forces each of us to consider what is essential in our lives and what doesn't matter so much. And the pandemic offers an opportunity for humankind to hit the reset button, a chance to change the way we do things and to create a civilization in which the environmental crisis and the climate emergencies are addressed.
Ben, you make a great point there. And of course, listening to yourself, the peer-reviewed papers, it is a form of optimism in the sense that there's a roadmap. We know what we need to do. We know what the problems are, and therefore we should know what we need to do. However, you brought up COVID-19, and I think this is a warning. It's the latest warning. There have been many others. We can't pretend otherwise. So, but at the same time, Ben, this is the concern. We see it, we read it, we watch it. There is a desire, a human need to go back to, and I'll put it in inverted commas, normal, right? And you're seeing it already in America, in the UK, despite huge death tolls. They're going back to beaches when they're told not to. They're congregating when they're told not to. They're not conforming to social distancing measures when they're supposed to. So this desire to go back to normal as soon as possible, what does that mean? Normal means cutting down huge swathes of forest. Normal means overgrazing livestock. Normal means destroying ecosystems. You know, normal drives climate change. So my concern, my question is, can we learn from this pandemic? Will we do the right thing as a species? Because there's enough evidence to show that there's a minority that will not do the right thing. So will we learn from this pandemic and do what needs to be done to give the planet a fighting chance? Or will we just rush to the nearest McDonald's first chance we get as a species?
Well, I mean, I think you make some very good points here. As we come out of the pandemic, we need structural changes to the economy and industry, not just behavioural changes, which is why we've seen this improvement in pollution or the expansion of short-term expansion in wildlife. I mean, we've just seen behavioural changes because we're not flying. The economy's shut down. We are working from home. We are driving less. We need the structural changes. And that's going to require individuals to want this to happen. How do we do that? Well, we have to, in many cases, it's through education, making sure that climate and sustainabilities are a top priority. For example, at NTU, that they're a top priority for every single undergraduate that is educated at this university, that a core course is in climate and sustainability. So as they go out to be leaders in the workforce in Singapore and beyond, they're educated in this manner. Because yes, we need to act quickly on climate change, but we need to have educated solutions. The other thing is to try and think about, well, what have we learnt in the past? Well, we had the financial crash in 2008, and there were some small investments by government into renewable energies. I saw a paper that estimated around 16% of the stimulus package went into renewable energies. But the impacts of that were huge in terms of the efficiency of solar voltaics. In the last decade, they've gone down over 80%. The efficiency in batteries, the efficiency in wind farms. So as we come out of this, we can start to think about, well, where can we invest money in what you'd call shovel-ready projects? Here in Singapore, they've talked about making all the cars electric within the next decade. Well, why can't they, as we try to put investment into Singapore, why can't we make that a priority to happen in the next 12 to 24 to 36 months? They've talked about green corridors and having bike lanes to allow people to commute in other manners. Again, why can't we make that a priority? I mean, car companies in general, they are massively struggling now. Why can't we have governmental incentives around the world that will hasten the move from petrol to diesel engines? I mean, I'm always aware in climate change that, you know, you have to think about the established industries that rely on carbon. You can't just say get rid of them, because there are people who work in those industries that rely on income to pay their mortgages, to have their health service. So we need to think of appropriate bailouts to allow this sector of the industry to recover, but to recover in a green and sustainable solution. It's not going to be easy. I mean, if it was easy, we would have done it. But as a species, yeah, we've always responded to crises. And individuals, in many ways, we can see this, they don't particularly like being told what to do. And so what climate change is about, and this paper is about, is knowledge. This paper provides knowledge about what happens if you have a low emission future or a high emission future. And then the individual can decide.
Yeah. Ben, is that paper available for the public to look at outside of the articles in which it's been published?
Yes, it is. I mean, we again, one of the things, I also work for the Earth Observatory of Singapore. And the Earth Observatory of Singapore, one of its remits is to make sure that all of the academic articles are available free to anyone in the world. Primarily, the Earth Observatory works not only in Singapore, which has two very well-paid universities, but interacts with many universities in and around Southeast Asia, which do not have the financial means to obtain this data. And indeed, people outside academia have difficult means to obtain. But at the Earth Observatory, we make all of our papers freely available. So all you really need to do is you need to search my name, Benjamin Horton, and type in sea level rise and nature, and then it will come up and you can click on it and it will be freely available to download and read.
Perfect. Our thanks to Professor Ben Horton, Chair of the Asian School of the Environment at NTU. Always a pleasure to have you on to put things in perspective and help us understand what's happening in the physical world around us. Thank you so much, Ben.
Thank you.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.